From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, State House Speaker Kevin Cotter on medical marijuana and energy policy, failing schools and charter schools.
Competition is a good thing, and the competition results in all performance rising. So I think charter schools are a great option.
Plus, author Alexander Weinstein questions whether we control technology or it controls us.
It definitely came out of my fear for where we're heading. Right? We're all embracing technology with wide open arms and getting more and more trapped in our phones. I mean, I stop at a red light, I look over, and there are people checking their phones constantly.
And sports commentator John Eubanks on Tom Izzo becoming a Hall of Famer.
As I said about Bo, I'll say about Izzo. His values will outlive his victories. Talk to his former players.
Those stories and more. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Can foundations take a lesson from breweries with microlending? And will a recent ruling bring about changes for graduate assistants on university of campuses? But first, summer vacation is now just a memory for students and for the Michigan legislature. We wanted to explore some of the issues facing the State House of Representatives in the fall weeks ahead. And for that, we welcome the Speaker of the State House. He represents the 99th District around Mount Pleasant. House Speaker Kevin Cotter is here with us now. Mr. Speaker, welcome.
Well, thank you so much. Great to be with you.
Let's start with medical marijuana. The state Senate just sent you what's arguably the most comprehensive marijuana package that we've seen since the 2008 adoption, allowing for dispensaries with a tiered system of growers and distributors and taxation at the retail point. What do you think you and the House will do with this?
Well, we're looking at that right now. The Senate did just pass it on Thursday, and they're sending back to us some bills that we sent over nearly a year ago. So we're spending some time to understand the changes that were made, and I think you'll see us consider that bill this week.
Do you think things need to be worked on, or might it be voted on as is?
You know, it could be voted on as is. We're taking time, again, just to understand these changes. But, you know, I think it's important. A lot of work has gone into this, and it's important that we have a system that provides safe and reliable access.
Let's pivot over to energy policy, Mr. Speaker. There's a comprehensive package of energy policy bills that have been winding their way through the legislature. Is this something that you think could get done before November, or might it have to wait until lame duck?
My hope is that it gets done one way or the other this calendar year, whether that's before the election or after the election. We've been working on this for a long time now, and energy policy, I have to say, is probably the most technical area of subject matter that we consider. That's why so much work has gone into this. We want to make sure that we get it right. We want to make sure, again, that we have a reliable system of affordable energy for all classes of users, whether that be a business user or whether that be folks in their homes. So it's something we've been working on in great detail with the Senate. And my hope is that one way or the other, we can put this thing to bed this calendar year.
What are some of the holdups for you and your caucus?
You know, who will be providing energy in Michigan? Will it be what we call the incumbent utilities, or alternatively, will there be alternative markets out there? That's probably one of the more contentious pieces of this. And so there are some that want to provide for choice and competition, and there are others that say, well, because it's energy, we need to have a more closed system. So that's probably the biggest sticking point. But we'll also be looking at other things, such as how much of our energy should be coming from renewable sources, and do we look at the mandate that we passed several years ago that required a certain amount of our energy, a certain percentage of our energy to come from alternative sources. So those are just a couple of the issues in what is a very complex area.
Let's turn over to the schools, particularly the schools considered to be failing in that bottom 5%. We know that 47 of the schools on the state's list of the 100 worst performing schools are in Detroit, and the school reform office is saying that those failing schools may be shut down at the end of the year. You and Senator Arlen Meekhoff have asked Attorney General Schuette for his view on whether the current law allows the school reform office to shut down Detroit's failing schools in this new system, the Detroit Public Schools Community District, and do it at the end of this school year. Now, the governor is saying he supports the view that the schools in this new district should get 3 years to improve their performance. Why not wait 3 years?
Well, the reason why, when we passed this package, you know, bills related to public schools in Detroit, we knew at the time, and I believe today when I look at the language, it's very clear what we were voting on, and that was that these schools would close at the end of the year. The reason that is so important is because these are the schools, again, that are among the worst performing schools in the state, and they've been that way for at least 3 years. So the students of every corner of the state, whether they're in Detroit or whether they're in the western part of the Upper Peninsula, deserve an opportunity at a quality education. And if a school is in that bottom 5% for 3 years, then that's certainly not the case for these students. What the governor's interpretation is that because we created a new district in Detroit, that that somehow created a fresh clock for these schools and that they would have to be failing for three additional years going forward. In our view, it's not fair to trap these students in failing schools for an additional 3 years, but rather they should be closed at the end of the calendar year. I think the language that we passed is very clear, and I'm confident that the Attorney General will see it that way as well.
I've got to wonder why close instead of, for example, let's talk about these schools in Detroit, giving them a chance to improve with the help of this new district.
Well, when we see proficiency rates, whether you're looking at reading levels, just as an example, that are literally in the low teens, in some cases 13% of all students are proficient, that's beyond repair. We've got to look at other options. And the bills that we passed do apply statewide when we look at school closures. And so the governor's interpretation of the language would actually create a double standard. And it would say that public schools outside of Detroit will close at the end of the calendar year, whereas the Detroit schools would get an additional 3 free years of additional failure potentially. We've got to move on. These kids cannot afford to wait, and they deserve better, and it's our hope that we're going to bring that to them.
What is so special about that 5%, the bottom 5%? Why that figure?
Clearly 5%, whether it were 3% or 8%, they're arbitrary numbers. But at the end of the day, we have to pick a number when we start to look at closures. And again, when you look at these proficiency rates, they are so incredibly low. We could have gone potentially higher, but 5%, I think, is a good start. And I think that it's going to motivate all schools that say, hey, the state is serious now about quality education. And to the extent that we fail, then other options are going to be looked at. But again, you got to keep in mind when we look at that bottom 5%, which is the worst performing schools, we're not talking about just a single year, but three consecutive years.
What if the Attorney General does not rule on your request or gives you an opinion that you maybe don't want to hear or doesn't rule in a timely fashion? What are your plans?
Well, here's what we could do. So the Attorney General is ruling on the language that we passed. If he were to come back, not in our favor, but rather say that, no, this language is not clear and these schools get an additional 3 years, what we could do at that point was we could then look at clarifying the language. However, that becomes challenging because we would be passing a new law and that would require the governor's signature. So we'd have to make sure that he were on board with that. And those are conversations that we could have.
We're speaking with the Speaker of Michigan's House, Kevin Cotter. Mr. Cotter, there's no secret that the DeVos family has certainly led the charge to bring charter schools into Michigan. They, at the same time, they're pouring donations into candidates, state PACs, and Republican Party organizations in Michigan. The Michigan Campaign Finance Network reports the DeVos family has given some $8 million to the Michigan GOP and to the House Republican Campaign Committee and the Senate Republican Campaign Committee. They gave $1.45 million, almost unprecedented amount to your party and affiliate organizations just in June and July alone. Do these contributions make a difference as you are crafting decisions about schools in Detroit or throughout Michigan?
No, in my opinion, they don't. You know, the DeVos family, just like many other families and groups out there that want to see quality educational outcomes, they have that commitment. They've been very vocal about it, and they happen to make contributions to both political organizations as well as other charitable organizations. So I just see them as a group, as a family that's very committed to the success in Michigan, and they happen to be very committed to educational causes. But at the end of the day, that does not have an impact on decision-making. I think it's a noble position to want to see all tides rise when we're looking at education.
Can you understand how to some people in this state, you and Senator Meekhoff and others in the legislature, are basically dancing to a charter school tune that's being played by the DeVos family? How do you respond to that?
I think that's absolutely ridiculous. I have always been a proponent of charter schools. I go back to my very first campaign and 6-7 years ago and see that on literature. The reason that I do support that is because I think that competition is a good thing, and that competition results in all performance rising. So I think charter schools are a great option. And it's something that even here in my community, so many parents are happy that they have the choice to choose a charter school if they choose. As we saw in Detroit when we were considering these bills, 53%, I believe was the number, just over half, 53% of all parents in Detroit have already voted with their feet. They've taken their kids out of these DPS, Detroit Public Schools, that are not performing, and they've sent them to charters. And as we look at how these schools compare in performance, make no doubt about it, there are poor performing charters in some parts of the city, in some parts of the state.
I want to change subjects here. Former Representatives Todd Corser and Cindy Gamrat wound up last week by filing lawsuits. Mr. Corser's suit in particular, suing you and just about everybody else, including the Lansing Hotel where the two were meeting. Looking back, would you have done anything differently in the way you handled these two individuals?
absolutely not. Very proud of the way we handled a very difficult situation. You know, it's unfortunate that Mr. Corser hasn't moved on with his life, but as we saw last week with the filing of this ridiculous lawsuit, apparently he hasn't. Unfortunately, additional taxpayer resources will be spent to defend against a very frivolous lawsuit. This is just like a bad dream that won't go away. But as far as how we handled it at the time, I stand by the way that the House of Representatives, as well as my office, myself personally, how that was handled. Again, it's something that fortunately does not happen very often, but occasionally there are bad eggs that have to be dealt with.
I would have to say, and all due respect, sir, it's one of the most serious actions a legislative body can take, expelling one of its members. And your votes failed twice, and it took almost 14 hours to finally get something done. You don't regret counting the votes first before putting it up?
No, absolutely not. What happened there was the Democrats were playing games with us. We needed a large number of votes to get that bill to pass, and they were playing games with it. So we put it up on the board and held the board open while we waited for them to cast their votes. It's a sad situation that you see political games being played at a situation so serious as that, but that was the reality.
Finally, are you supporting Mr. Trump for president? Will you vote for him in November?
I will be voting for him, yes.
What about his down-ticket effect on your House majority? Are there any concerns at all amongst the state GOP that you could lose the House?
No, I don't think so. I feel pretty confident about our prospects for maintaining a majority for a fourth consecutive term. But as you look at the dynamics this year, this certainly is an interesting situation. You have two candidates, both Donald Trump as well as Hillary, who I think anyone would say their favorability ratings are less than average. But we see that it varies greatly across the state, depending on what part of the state you're looking at, as to how these respective candidates are doing. And, you know, in a lot of the battleground seats this time around, we see that Donald Trump is actually doing quite well. So I'm optimistic about the prospects of maintaining a majority this year. We have a great slate of candidates. We have, I believe, a great list of accomplishments that are good for the brand, and I expect that we're going to hold the majority.
Michigan House Speaker Kevin Cotter, thank you so much for speaking with us today on Stateside.
You're so welcome. Thanks for having me.
Stateside reached out to Senate Majority Leader Arlen Meekhoff, but he declined our request for an interview. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Whether you like it or not, it appears the legality of Michigan's emergency manager law has been settled today. An appeals court has ruled in favor of Governor Rick Snyder in a challenge to Michigan's Republican-passed emergency manager law. The appeals court upheld a decision by a federal judge who swept aside much of that lawsuit in 2014. Emergency managers essentially have the power to run local governments and school districts and supersede the authority of locally elected officials. Critics sued, arguing that the law violated many constitutional rights. The appeals court says the law might not be the perfect remedy, but it is, in their words, rationally related to fixing distressed local governments. Michigan voters, you'll recall, overturned Snyder's first emergency manager law in 2012, but he and lawmakers quickly returned with another EM law, this time with an appropriations measure tacked on so it would be referendum-proof. You are listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio.
Creation.
Curiosity.
The next idea.
We weren't setting out to do these huge things. We were just starting with solving a problem we hoped a few other people had.
You've got an idea for a startup. You've done your homework, developed a business plan, but it takes capital to pump up your idea and bring it to life. What if you're just too small to secure the loan you need to grow your business? The answer could be microlending. Our latest contributor to The Next Idea is the CEO of GROW, Grand Rapids Opportunities for Women. Since launching in 2011, GROW's microloan program has served 53 businesses with loans of over $1 million. And with us now from GROW is Bonnie Nowara. Bonnie, thank you for joining us on The Next Idea.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
What is microlending?
Microlending, it means many different things in many different countries, but in the United States, microlending is small pools of money that are loaned to people who are what we normally call non-bankable. So they may have some credit issues, maybe some tax liens, those types of things.
And why did your organization, your CEO of GROW, why did you decide to start doing it in West Michigan?
We decided to start doing it in West Michigan because at the time there was not another microlender, and we worked with a lot of businesses that had great ideas and wanted to begin businesses but didn't have access to capital.
And so give us an idea. How big are the typical loans and what are the terms?
Sure. Your loan can be as small as $1,000 and right now as high as $50,000, although with the CDFI designation, which we just received in May, will go up to $250,000. The average size loan, however, is about $15,000. And the terms can be up to 6 years, or if you're, you know, if you've got the capacity to pay the loan back sooner, then we can work with smaller year terms as well.
Now, people certainly may have heard of microlending, for example, in Bangladesh. A woman buys chickens with her loan and then is able to sell the eggs as a way to improve her family's situation. What does microlending look like here in Michigan and the kinds of businesses that you're serving with microloans?
Well, the money that we loan can be used to purchase business equipment, supplies, materials, inventory, working capital. For instance, we made a loan to a woman who she's buying these knitting machines and she's creating these compression clothing is what it is. And so very similar to the tension bands that you put around your wrist, maybe if you sprain your wrist, only this particular clothing item just puts the compression in the area that needs to be compressed. And it's a specific sewing machine. And so we loaned her the money for that machine. We loaned money to a gentleman who wanted to start a barber shop. He had been a barber for another organization or another company for many years, and he wanted to go out on his own. We loaned money to a young man who does small engine repair.
How many jobs do you think might have been created by the micro lending that Grow has done?
Well, I can tell you that for 2015, in the funds that we've currently loaned, that we had 53 new businesses. We funded 21 new startups and created 92 new jobs.
And as you kind of said, these are things that might not have happened because the whole idea might have been crushed at the very outset by being unable to get a loan from a bank.
Exactly. Another benefit to microlending is we work with them to make them what we call bankable. So we get a lot of support from our banks for this program. And we have a lot of our community bankers as volunteers on this program. And so we work with these clients and we work with them and teach them how to be financially responsible, how to set up their financials, how to set up their accounting systems so that when they pay our loan back and they need, say, a line of credit from a bank, their chances of obtaining that line of credit are greater.
Bonnie, in your view, what are some of the biggest barriers to small business people getting access to capital in this state?
I think that there's plenty of access to the capital in this state. I mean, there's all kinds of funds out there. I think the biggest barrier is what we call becoming loan ready. And that means you have to know what you're doing with that business. You have to have a viable business plan and you have to have some forecasting. I mean, you, as a business owner, you have to truly be vested and you have to be the one that's a champion for your business and articulate for that business and prove to whoever's going to loan you the money that you are credit worthy and have the capacity to pay the money back.
What do you see as the future of microlending in Michigan?
I think there's going to be more funds that are coming into our community for business startup. It's a very good thing, right? So I think there's going to be more funding. I think that you're going to see segments in funding. So right now, with technology, there are some funds out there that are specifically for technology-based businesses. So I think you're going to see some segmentation.
Bonnie Nowara is the CEO of Grow, Grand Rapids Opportunities for Women, using microlending to get small businesses, help them take root and come to life. Bonnie, thanks so much for being with us on The Next Idea. It was great hearing from you.
Thank you.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. The National Labor Relations Board has done a complete about-face. The board recently voted 3-1 that graduate students working as teaching or research assistants at private universities are indeed employees with a right to collective bargaining. That ruling overturns a 2004 Bush-era ruling that took those bargaining rights away. So how might this recent ruling impact working conditions, pay, and benefits for all graduate employees? With us now is John Ware, the president of the Graduate Employees Organization at the University of Michigan. John, welcome.
Hi, great to be here.
Now, this ruling from the NLRB pertains to graduate employees at private universities. Could it have an impact on folks who are at public universities like Michigan?
You know, it doesn't have a direct legal impact on public universities, but I think it has an enormous symbolic importance. We really are all part of a big national movement in higher education, and I think the strength of that movement anywhere, it does have an impact on graduate employees across the country, both at the private and the public institutions.
Now, I think for a lot of us, we don't fully understand the academic hierarchy that exists on campuses and where graduate employees fit into that and exactly what they do. So could you break it down for us?
Yeah. So graduate employees work doing a number of the functions of the university. So the two big categories that you hear about, for example, in the NLRB ruling are instruction and research, which you really can think of as the two most important missions of almost any university, right? So, for example, at the University of Michigan, graduate student instructors are responsible for about 23% of student contact hours. So we teach courses. We hold discussion sections and language sections. We teach labs. We hold office hours. We do grading. So those are all instructional functions. And then graduate student research assistants are really, along with postdoctoral researchers, the main category of people who are in the lab doing the research, or in the field, or, you know, on the computer analyzing data.
So there's a lot of contribution on many levels from graduate employees. So what kind of issues led to the creation, for instance, of the Graduate Employees Organization at Michigan? I mean, you're saying this part of a big conversation and an increasing awareness of where graduate employees fit in and how things could be better. So what led to the creation of your group?
So the GEO is one of the oldest organizations of its kind in the country, and it's actually 15 years older than I am. And so I can only speak to the creation secondhand, but I can tell you about some of the issues that are kind of have always been of paramount importance for graduate employees. At the time the GEO was founded in the 1970s, it was not common for graduate employees to have health insurance. Many were uninsured, and it was not common for us to have tuition reimbursement. And I really see those as issues of access, right? Many of the graduate programs are really long, and if you have to pay tuition, they would be enormously expensive. And that education would be accessible then only to people with a lot of independent means.
Sure, sure.
So I think now it's become much more common, especially in PhD programs, to have tuition reimbursement. And certainly by no means all, but many of the graduate employees at many of the institutions now have health insurance. To a large degree, that's because of the work that was done by the early graduate unions, you know, in the 80s and 90s.
It certainly seems that there's a real back and forth as this conversation continues. And we, you know, as we talked about this recent ruling from the NLRB, whether graduate employees are indeed employees or are they students who are getting a chance to learn more by teaching? Is that kind of been the tension back and forth between where universities stood versus where the graduate employees stand?
You know, I think that dichotomy is often set up between are we employees or are we students? And I think as the NLRB recognized in their ruling, it's really a false dichotomy. We are students and we are employees. And the universities have sometimes tried to argue that we can't be both.
Surely it's to their bottom line benefit to have you be students who don't need to get a lot of benefits and pay.
It certainly is.
Yeah. I guess as we see this decision coming down saying that the folks who are at private universities have a right to collective bargaining, you're saying that this really kind of sends a big warning shot across the bow, if you will, in the conversation about what can and should happen with graduate employees. How could union representation and collective bargaining be a game changer?
I think there are a couple of areas that are really key. One is the bread and butter issues, compensation and benefits, which at a lot of the universities are still really meager, especially compared to the cost of living where a lot of the universities are located. You know, even a place like Ann Arbor it's a very expensive place to live. The cost of housing continues to go up. So that's sort of bread and butter issues. But I think another big category is workload. graduate student employees have a lot of responsibilities to balance. In addition to their paid work, they're often taking courses and or they're trying to do their own research and write their dissertations and maintain sufficient academic progress. And if the paid work component of the program takes up too much time, it really detracts from what can be the student's academic progress. That's a place where there's an opportunity for a lot of improvement.
I think parents and students who are paying tuition are going to look at this from another point of view. What might this NLRB decision ultimately mean for the instruction or the caliber of instruction offered in classes taught by graduate students?
You know, I think it's said a lot, and I think it's true, our working conditions are our students' learning conditions. And an instructor can only really be at their most effective when they have adequate time and energy to prepare for the course, when they're not preoccupied with their financial situation, with whether they're going to be able to make rent or to buy food or whether they're going to be crippled by medical bills. And I think we are going to see a real improvement in the quality of instruction at the private universities as the graduate students do organize and do form themselves into unions. And their general quality of life improves. I think that's going to be good for their students also.
All right. So we have this decision that applies to research assistants at private universities. How long do you think it will take before this filters out into public universities as well?
You know, the public universities are governed by state labor law. So it differs from state to state whether any graduate employees are entitled to collective bargaining. And secondly, whether that's only instructional work or also research assistants.
So, what's your take on what might happen in Michigan?
So I really do hope that the states, and especially in our case, the state of Michigan, will take a cue from the Labor Relations Board. But frankly, it is a political issue, and there's a lot of ideological control in the state government. Some folks who are really just anti-union in all cases. And so I think, you know, there are some in government who really are going to be moved by the argument and by the experience of the private universities as they unionize and find that to be good for the institution. So hopefully some of those folks will come along. But there are others who are just ideologically stuck in the mud, and I don't see them going anywhere.
Now, could a university take a look and say, you know, yeah, maybe we do need to step up the game?
Well, I think actually the University of Michigan in a lot of cases has tried to do that. Mm-hmm. So there was a big organizing drive here for research assistants in 2011, 2012. And the regents of the university actually declared that they weren't going to interfere in that drive and that the research assistants could make their own choice. And so I think the university actually did see it see the issue pretty clearly, and it was the state government that stepped in and overruled them.
So you're wearing a T-shirt that says GEO Contract Campaign 2016-2017. What's the point of the campaign?
That's right. So we bargain a new contract usually every 3 or 4 years, and this year we'll be bargaining a new contract for graduate student instructors and graduate student staff assistants. They're mostly librarians. Mm-hmm. So we're a democratic organization, and it's always up to the members what the priorities are in bargaining. But I can tell you that we have, over the last couple of years, fallen behind the cost of living in Ann Arbor, especially with the cost of housing going up as it has. So I'm sure that's going to be a big issue. And then we're always concerned to hang on to the great benefits and protections that we already have in our contract, and not to end up paying more for health insurance or to lose the protections we have on our work hours.
John Ware, president of the Graduate Employees Organization at the University of Michigan. John, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and it's time for our weekly check-in with Michigan Radio sports commentator John Ubakin. And let us start with the most recent event, work our way back through the weekend. How about those Lions?
How about them Lions? They won a football game, is what the news is here.
39-35 over the Colts. It was really clear from fan comments and social media. People were delighted, and they were totally stunned.
They had blown it a couple of times during the game, playing the Colts, not a bad team, with Andrew Luck, one of Harbaugh's old quarterbacks at Stanford. But they did, in fact, pull it out, I think, to the shock of almost all Lions fans.
Who deserves to take a bow most, do you think?
Dumb Luck.
Well, talk about Matthew Stafford. How'd he do?
Stafford is doing better. Look, he's in his eighth year, I believe. So
he's not a rookie.
The honeymoon's over.
Yeah.
He's got to kind of prove himself now, or, you know, he'll be forever a second-tier quarterback. So he played very well, obviously. The Lions themselves, I mean, look, they played a solid team. NFL games are designed to come down to two or three plays.
Over to the Tigers fighting for a wild card spot in the playoffs. And we know Baltimore came to Comerica Park one game up on the Tigers, and they left town two games up. What did him in over this weekend?
The problem all season, of course, has been relief pitching, and that was a problem in one of these games. But basically, to win a game, you need three things. You need hitting, starting pitching, and relief pitching. These are now two different categories. And the Tigers always had at least one of those fail miserably in all three games.
Cabrera didn't get a hit all weekend.
That's a problem.
That's a problem.
Cabrera is one of the obviously best players in the major leagues. Got a great bat, yeah. So bad timing there.
We want to talk about what it feels like to be Dodgers pitcher Rich Hill. He played, of course, for Michigan, we should know. Talk to us about that win over the Marlins Saturday that felt like a sucker punch right to the stomach.
I need to explain what a perfect game is. Now, a shutout, of course, is no runs. A no-hitter is no hits. You're allowed to hit the ball, of course. You don't actually get to first base. A perfect game is no runs, no hits, no errors, no walks. No one got on base ever. In the history of baseball, going back to the 1800s, there have been exactly 23 perfect games.
Boy, oh boy.
The Dodgers have not had one since Sandy Koufax in 1965. Cindy, I was one. And I'm no longer one. So this guy, Rich Hill, who's late in his career, he's 36, still throwing for the Dodgers. He's got a perfect game going through seven innings. And trust me, by then, everyone knows it. The manager, Dave Roberts, is next to him between innings and says, I'm not going to put you out there because he's got a few blisters on his pitching fingers, which seem to be fine, but they're playing it very safe. And there's an argument for it. You're playing for the playoffs.
Sure.
You can't get injured and so on. But come on.
If you were the manager, you'd let him stay.
Absolutely. Mm. And by the way, this pitch count nonsense is nonsense. The idea of saving a guy's arm is true and too late. I mean, years ago, you just burned the guys out. But how we set this at 100 pitches has got no science behind it. There's no, other than a nice round number, who knows? And by the way, they don't count warm-up pitches. Your arm doesn't care if the ball's in play or not. It's still stressing your arms. I don't get the whole thing.
Wow. I want to get your thoughts, John, on the Central Michigan victory over Oklahoma State. A miraculous Hail Mary at the final play of the game, happening because the officials messed up.
And before that, there are three things that happened here. First of all, if you've not seen this play, beam it up. It's the coolest play of the college season so far and the biggest upset of the season so far. A MAC team goes down there to Oklahoma, plays 22nd-ranked Oklahoma State. Big upset, but with about 4 seconds left, Oklahoma State has got the ball. All you have to do is run backwards 10 yards and roll around as though on fire, and the game is over. So they screwed up with that one. That's their fault. Then the referee screwed up because the guy threw the ball away. Intentional grounding is called. They called it. Then they gave Central the ball back with unlimited time. The game should have been over. The refs screwed up. Both the MAC refs representing Central and the Big 12 refs doing the replay for Oklahoma State, they both screwed up. So Central's now got the ball. And here's the cool part. It's amazing. Quarterback Cooper Rush, great name.
Yes.
Launches the ball. He hits Jesse Kroll around the 10-yard line. As he's falling down, he pitches the ball, laterals it to a guy named Malik Fountain, who scampers across the field, all right, all the way into the end zone. The most amazing play I've seen all year and maybe in a while.
Well, they messed up so badly. I know the MAC suspended the eight-man crew for two games. And
both sides, the MAC crew as well as the Big 12 crew.
Yeah.
They deserve it. But so what? If you're Central, man, hop on that plane.
I guess so. But in the interest of fairness, when an officiated blows it so badly, why is there no recourse for the team that lost because of that big old mistake?
You know what? This is old school, and I'm sure lawyers will hate me for this, but I kind of like the fact that, you know what? There's no tears. Game's over. It's unfair. It's not right. You recall a few years ago, a Tigers pitcher had a perfect game going.
Yes.
Into the ninth inning, and the first base umpire made the wrong call. The guy was out at first base, the final out. Nobody could believe it, and both are now celebrated for that fact. But that, it's just tough rocks. Mm. Only in sports, you can't legislate this stuff.
Finally, we can't let you go without letting you give a hat tip to the newest member of the Basketball Hall of Fame.
Tom Izzo, that's a other shoe dropping. That's so obvious. He is heralded for his values, for his victories. As I said about Bo, I'll say about Izzo. His values will outlive his victories. Talk to his former players. He gets bigger over time. The guy's one of my all-time favorites.
And it is certainly clear from hearing him talk, you can take the kid out of the UP, but you will never take the UP out of the kid.
He is very proud of that fact.
It's wonderful. Michigan Radio Sports commentator, John Eubank. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Something happened this summer in the Ann Arbor Park where I like to walk at night. The people who walked and talked together were, by and large, supplanted by large groups of people basically sitting around staring at their smartphones, or maybe walking slowly staring at their smartphones. Yes, Pokemon Go players flocked to this particular park. And then I read Alexander Weinstein's new book of short stories, Children of the New World, telling stories of dangerously immersive virtual reality games, ordering up robots to round out your family, reading email on your eyes, living in memories you download, of being controlled by technology and social media, not the other way around. Alexander Weinstein is an associate professor of English at Siena Heights University. He directs the Martha's Vineyard Institute of Creative Writing, leads fiction workshops across the country and Canada, and among his writing awards, a Sustainable Arts Foundation Award, the Lamar York, Gail Crump, and New Millennium Prizes. Children of the New World is his first short story collection. Alexander Weinstein, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, clearly, you've been working on these stories for, what, years now?
Yeah, 10 years.
Wow.
This is a 10-year collection.
And Pokemon Go hit big over this summer, but am I off base in that sense of discomfort I cannot get over at seeing so many people in the middle of this beautiful park who do not lift their eyes from the phone screen?
Yeah. Pokemon Go, I'm working somewhere in my subconscious right now with the Pokemon Go story because it's so absurd and such a great metaphor for this strange place we find ourselves in, right? I mean, you have people finding dead bodies through Pokemon Go. You've got grown men walking off cliffs and then everybody staring down at their phones.
And flocking together. Like that. Yeah. When it first started happening, what is happening here?
Yeah. And I see it as a metaphor. I mean, I've been thinking a lot about the spiritual metaphor of Pokemon Go, right? That we're all searching for these lost creatures who are ultimately ourselves, right? And seeking it through the phones and everybody looking down. It really sort of captures the technological craziness that we're in.
And certainly that you spell out in these stories that are collected in Children of the New World. And just to give everyone a sense of kind of what these stories are about, I'm going to give you the title of a story and you can kind of give us the kernel of what it is, like the elevator pitch, if you will.
Right.
The Cartographers.
So that's a corporation that manufactures memories. Quimbley, Barrett and Woods out of New York, they're making memories for people that want better parents, better childhoods. They just want a vacation that's cheaper to go on so they can have these memories implanted.
And you just download those memories and there they are.
Yeah.
Children of the New World.
That's a couple who has gone past the point of having children. And so they're able to have children through this new virtual technology where their avatars can get pregnant. And they didn't realize this when they signed on. And they end up with two virtual children that they love very much.
And then things ensue. We'll just say that. Migration. That was so touching.
Yeah. Similarly, another virtual world where everyone's living online and nobody goes outside anymore. Everybody just works online. They get their food shipped to them. And the crux of it is a teenage boy who wants to go bicycling.
And he goes outside.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to give you a baby boomer moment, everybody listening and you. These stories remind me of the kinds of challenging stories that I remember watching on those 60s-era TV shows, The Twilight Zone and The Outer Limits. Rod Serling would do The Twilight Zone, the things that are grounded in our reality and kind of show us where we could go wrong. So maybe not so much satire, but a warning. Is that a fair way to look at these stories?
They're definitely warnings, right? And hopefully there's a lot of humor in it and compassion, too. But it definitely came out of my fear for where we're heading.
Yeah.
Right? We're all embracing technology with wide open arms and getting more and more trapped in our phones. I mean, I stop at a red light, I look over, and there are people checking their phones constantly.
Absolutely.
At bus stops, you have people launching birds at pigs, right? And I mean, these are grown people that are standing there playing these games.
Or go into a restaurant and watch a table of people.
Completely. Whole families sitting through the whole meal, just checking their iPhones, sending updates, doing new posts on their Facebook feeds. It's mildly depressing, right?
And you're a teacher, so you're seeing students.
Absolutely. That's where some of this came from. I mean, my students were saying, recently they've been saying they prefer texting to talking to people.
We say this to our 22-year-old daughter all the time. Why don't you phone them? Call them. Like
yeah.
They're all texting away.
Yeah, people say they're afraid. I was actually asking the students about, so how do you date? And would you call somebody for a date? And they said, no, absolutely not. You'd never talk to them. And I said, why not? And they said, well, it's too frightening. Right? And so there's this connection for the new millennials generation and the one that's coming after them where you – I mean, you see babies in cribs being given
An iPad or something
to play with, to entertain them. So we're there. We're definitely in the sci-fi future already.
Would you read us an excerpt, if you will, from Children of the New World? And this is the beginning of the story that you title Openness. And I think it'll give everybody a good sense of the not-too-distant science sci-fi future that you envision.
Before I decided to finally give up on New York, I subbed classes at a junior high in Brooklyn. A sixth grade math teacher, suffering from downloading anxiety, was out for the year. And jobs being what they were, I took any opportunity I could. Subbing math was hardly my dream job. I had a degree in visual art for which I'd be in debt for the rest of my life. All I had to show for it was my senior collection, a series of paintings of abandoned playgrounds stored in a U-Pack shed in Ohio. There was a time when I'd imagined I'd become famous, give guest lectures at colleges, have retrospectives at MoMA. Instead, I found myself standing in front of a class of apathetic tweens trying to teach them how to do long division without accessing their browsers. I handed out pen and paper so that for once in their lives, they'd have a tactile experience, and watched as they texted, their eyes glazed from blinking off message after message. They spent most of the class killing vampires and orcs inside their heads and humoring me by lazily filling out my photocopies. The city overwhelmed me. Every day I'd walk by hundreds of strangers, compete for space in crowded coffee shops, and stand shoulder to shoulder on packed subway cars. I'd scan profiles, learning that the woman waiting for the inn enjoyed thrash hop, and the barista at my local coffee shop loved salted caramel. I'd had a couple fleeting relationships, but mostly I'd spend weekends going to bars and sleeping with people who knew little more than my username. It all made me want to turn off my layers, go back to the old days, and stay disconnected. But you do that and you become another old guy, buried in an e-reader, complaining about how no one sends emails anymore. So I stayed open, shared the most superficial info of my outer layer with the world, and filtered through everyone I passed, hoping to find some connection. Here was City Cat 5, Jersey Girl 13, M3 Love. And then one morning there was Katie, sitting across from me on the N. She was Lake Girl 03, and her hair fell from under her knit cap. The only other info I could access was her hometown and that she was single. "Hi," I winked. And when I realized she had her tunes on, I sent off an invite. She raised her eyes. "Hi," she winked back. "Are you from Maine? I'm planning a trip there this summer. Any suggestions?" She leaned forward and warmth spread across my chest from being allowed into her second layer. "I'm Katie," she winked. "You should visit Bar Harbor. I grew up there." She gave me access to an image of a lake house with tall silvery pines rising high above the shingled roof. "Wish I could help more, but this is my stop." As she stood waiting for the doors to open, I winked a last message. "Can I invite you for a drink?" The train hissed, the doors opened, and she looked back at me and smiled before disappearing into the mass of early morning commuters. It was as the train sped toward work that her contact info appeared in my mind, along with a photo of her swimming in a lake at dusk.
That's Alexander Weinstein reading from his book of short stories, Children of the New World and Openness. So it's not hard to draw the line from where we are now to where this character is.
It's close.
It is close. Are you challenging, Alexander, people who are consumed by technology to stop, to put the brakes on, or what exactly?
Certainly to put the brakes on, just to take a pause for a moment, because we're hurtling towards this technological future and just saying, hold on a second, what are we losing? What are we trading off socially? What free time, for example? Do we want our free time back?
Technology was supposed to give us more free time.
Right. And instead we find ourselves updating online dating profiles, liking posts.
Checking Instagram to see who liked your latest picture.
Right. All these sort of sad outreaches for, you know, attention, right? Please love me, we seem to be saying. And then, of course, capturing Pokemon Go and God knows what else. Mm-hmm. And so we're doing that all the time. I mean, even myself, I find that I'm checking my phone 10 times a day, 20, 30.
Easily.
And so starting to realize, I think we all are seeing this, there's a kind of digital fatigue where people will take these Facebook breaks, right? They announce, I'm off for a week, right? And then they have this great, like, I'm back, you know, moment. And I think that's the start of us saying, you know what, I'd like to pull back a little bit. This is too much. What happened? And there's all sorts of course, natural effects of this, right? I mean, the open pit mines where all of the cell phone metals come from. And there's a big environmental cost, Apple suicide nets. You know, this is other stuff that we don't see, but that's equally important to start questioning. And of course, social media and technology and internet, all of this is great in many ways, right? For social protest, for getting information out.
Mm-hmm. Finding old friends, connecting.
Fantastic, yeah. Right? So somehow there's a balance needed. We're definitely out of balance, I would say, at this point, and that we're moving quicker and quicker. Now we have virtual reality coming. Google Glass sort of came and tried and went because we said no, but I think virtual reality, we seem to be excited and embracing.
It makes me wonder if we're going to see this generational divide where folks of a certain age that remember before we had no smartphones will feel one way. But I mean, we kind of see this in your stories and folks that, as you say, you see your students who don't want to even pick up hit call and talk to somebody.
Yeah, I think so. And then I think within the generations, you're also going to see a movement of people disconnecting. It's very hard to disconnect, though. I mean, it really is almost impossible at this point. And I think that may be what I'm trying to suggest too. Is there ways that we can break out of technology just for a little bit and go back to some of the simpler ways of communicating and creating community?
Well, it's a fascinating collection, Children of the New World, sci-fi, but very relatable, very grounded in where we are today. A collection of short stories by Alexander Weinstein. Such a pleasure to meet you, have you here, and loved your stories.
Oh, pleasure too. Thanks so much.
Alexander Weinstein will read from his book this Wednesday at 7 p.m. at Literati Bookstore in downtown Ann Arbor. For details, you can visit his website, alexanderweinsteinfiction.com. Stateside's producers are Ellie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, and Lindsay Scullin. Executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.